Okay, the topic of our discussion tonight is the Star of Bethlehem, a natural, supernatural hybrid question. Numerous suggestions have been made over the centuries for the identity of the star that led the Magi to Jesus. Some of these proposals can be classified as purely natural in that no miraculous intervention is postulated. For instance, Halley's Comet, or perhaps some other comet, or one or more of various planetary conjunctions or an exploding star, such as a supernova. Other proposals can be labeled purely supernatural, since they suggest that a miraculous object, perhaps an angel, the Shekinah glory, some other localized, movable light, bright light in the sky, was responsible for the phenomenon. The advantage of the first class of proposals, natural proposals, is that it may be possible to find other historical references to the object, or for Halley's Comet or planetary conjunctions, to reenact the scenario using modern computers. The problem with such proposals is that the bright object, being millions of miles out in space, does not naturally fit Matthew's comment that the star led the Magi to the place where the child was. Supernatural models, on the other hand, can easily be imagined in which a relatively local bright object will do the guiding, but it would be very unlikely that such an object would leave any extra-biblical traces in the historical record. Here we propose a hybrid model, part natural, part supernatural, that both leaves a distinctive mark for us to investigate 2,000 years later, and which also fits a natural reading of Matthew's account. Our proposal involves a modification of Ernest Martin's interpretation of a series of planetary and stellar conjunctions, followed by a localized bright object that would have been recognized by the Magi as the same star, and which on that crucial night led them to the house where the baby Jesus was. Okay, that's our introductory stuff. Before we go further on that, I'm going to walk you through planetarium program and see what we're looking at here. This is a reconstruction of the sky. The computer's not looking out there to see what's out there. Okay, it's a reconstruction of the sky at 8.06 p.m., which is not far off by the actual time, October 24, 2000, in Hatfield, PA. Okay, it gives you the longitude and latitude of the sky, and it tells you that it's displaying on the whole sphere, which we're only seeing a piece of, 7,971 stars, which is all the stars of magnitude 6.4 and brighter, and that it's looking towards the south. Okay, you can see the south horizon here, southwest horizon here, southeast horizon here. Now, there's a lot of stuff on there that aren't stars, okay? There's all the little red lines, and that helps people who are into stargazing to figure out what they're looking at. When you get outside, you have to do it by the stars, but on these things, it's hard to do it by that. And there's little green abbreviations for the particular the particular constellations that you're looking at. Up here, I've got a pointer somewhere here, but scrounge around and find it. There we are. Up here we're looking at Pegasus, the horse. And over here we're looking at Pisces, the fishes. And here Aquarius, the water bearer. And Capricornus, the fish goat. And Sagittarius, the archer. And Equus, I think, or Equileus, the horse anyway. So that's kind of what the sky looks like out there tonight. There's some purple stuff on here that are Messier objects, galaxies, star clusters, and things of that sort, and I'm going to take them off because the Magi weren't looking at those things, so if I figure out which thing to hit here to get rid of them, where was I up there, F4, they will disappear. I'm going to leave the other stuff up there. Okay, a little bit of a tour here of what the sky looks like. We're looking at the sky tonight, okay? Now, this is what the sky will look like tomorrow night. Shift it a little bit. What's going on? We're going around the sun, and as viewed from the north, imagine you're north of the solar system looking down, we're going counterclockwise around the sun. And so the sun is blocking out all the stars that are up at the moment when it's above the horizon, but then when it gets below, it isn't. So you're looking away from the sun when you're looking at a dark night sky, and that's going to gradually shift in the course of a year. In fact, it's going to shift all the way around in a circle. That big shift there was switching off a daylight time, okay? Okay. Otherwise, it just shifts a few minutes, but this Sunday we're going to switch out a daylight time, okay? So that's what that was. And otherwise, things are just going to go around like that, okay? So that's a shift. There's the moon going by right there. Moo, okay? They've stuck pretty strongly with three-letter abbreviations. There's Uranus, which is just barely visible. Neptune, which we cannot see without the naked eye. There's Saturn up there just coming on the edge, okay? Moon zapping past it, okay? there's Jupiter. Just came on up here on the left. Okay. And it's in Taurus, the bull. Okay. And the bright star Aldebaran or Aldebaran in Taurus. We're getting now over to the winter constellations. We're down to December 5th. Here's the moon coming back again. It makes a trip around just under once a month. Okay. That's why they call them months. Moons. Or something of that sort, what they were at one time. Okay. So it's going by Saturn. Now, right about here, you are getting a conjunction between the moon and Jupiter. I'll need to move it over a little bit to do that. Let me move just a few hours instead of a... notice a fairly big move on an hour, okay, because that's how much the thing moves. And the moon and Jupiter don't seem to be doing much because we're moving hours there. Moving whole days, the whole thing back around where it was before, just like the sun's around where it was. You know, at noon each day, the sun would be on the meridian. We're working at about 10 at night, though, in December. But somewhere in this next day, the moon is going to zap past. You see that? So if we back up, there it is. There was a conjunction between the moon and Jupiter sometime between those two times. Moon moves rather fast. Jupiter and Saturn are not moving relative to each other very fast at all because it takes 12 years for Jupiter to go around and longer than that for Saturn to make it around. So their relative motion seems to be quite small. There's the constellation Orion, which you may be one of you familiar with, and the Rigel and Betelgeuse, the two brightest stars in Orion. We're interested particularly in this line that runs this away, which is what we call the ecliptic. That's the line that the sun appears to move through during the course of the year. This is the constellation Gemini, the twins. There's the moon coming by again. And Cancer, a crab. You say, where's the sun? Well, we're staying at 10 p.m. at night, so you can guess where the sun is. Back here somewhere, okay, on the other side of the Earth. On the other hand, if we move around some hours, we can get the sun up. Okay, that's 11 at night, midnight. There's Leo. We're going to be looking at Leo and Virgo right behind him rather carefully. Leo here has kind of a head that looks like a sickle, and the tail part typically looks like a triangle if you look at it. Here they've got a little different arrangement of lines, on it. But we're going to be interested very much in Regulus, the brightest star in Leo. We're going to be interested in Virgo down here, the Virgin. So it's the constellation of the Lion, constellation of the Virgin, two of the big constellations in the zodiac, the 12 constellations. The sun runs through in the course of the year. There's the moon down here behind us and Mars, just coming up there. So you can get a little general idea where we're going there. What are we doing? We're moving times, okay? It's 7 a.m. now, so we ought to be getting some sun here pretty soon. But of course, we're in the south. Let's go look east. And now we're looking east here, and the sun's just about to rise at 7 a.m. on January 17th, 2001. So if you go on another hour, the sun will rise. There it is, with Neptune right behind it and Mercury pretty close behind it there. So, okay. So we've got a little feel. The constellations appear to go around in the sky. If you pick the same time at night, you will gradually see the constellations drifting westward and new constellations showing up. Go back to south here again if I can find the yes button. There you are. So that's basically what you're typically going to see. And we're going to be going back in the past here in just a bit to take a look at that. Let me move on to paper, the natural part of the paper. We talking about natural, supernatural, hybrid. So first section is going to be the natural part. Do we have evidence for something natural that looks spectacular enough, interesting enough, that it might be a candidate for being the star of Bethlehem? Although retrospective calculations of planetary position for ancient times have occasionally been made since the time of Johann Kepler, died 1630, such efforts being done by hand were enormously time-consuming, exacting, and tedious until very recently. In 1962, an early fruit of the development of the electronic computer was the publication of Bryant Tuckerman's Tables of Planetary, Lunar, and Solar Positions, 601 BC to AD 1, by the American Philosophical Society. Within a decade of this publication, Roger Sennett had worked carefully through these tables and located all the close planetary conjunctions that occurred around the probable time of the birth of Jesus. In particular, Sennett found one strikingly close conjunction of Venus and Jupiter in the constellation of Leo the Lion on the evening of 17 June 2 BC, which would have been quite rare. He proposed that this was the Christmas star, publishing his results in the December 1968 issue of Sky and Telescope, premier magazine of amateur astronomers. The suggestion has since been adopted and presented each Christmas in many planetarium programs. Ernest Martin, a former teacher at one of Herbert Armstrong's colleges in Britain, has developed the suggestion with much additional detail and historical research in his book, The Star That Astonished the World. Martin has noticed a cluster of additional conjunctions involving one or the other of these two planets within a year of this conjunction, and has suggested that these would have had such symbolic significance as to send the Magi to Judah to look for the newborn king of the Jews. Now, here's the conjunctions. You've got this in your paper as well, but maybe you'll see them a little bit better here. We've got the date over on the left, and we do the day first, so 12 August and the year 3, and since this is 3 and 2 B.C., these years are all B.C. Then he puts the local time of this conjunction in Babylon and in Jerusalem before the development of time zones. Local time was characteristic of each location, and that was measured essentially by saying 12 noon is when the sun crosses the meridian, more or less, and then you make adjustments. So this would be, and he's doing a 24-hour clock here, so 8:18 in the morning, Babylon, 7:41 in the morning, Jerusalem. Jupiter and Venus have a pretty close conjunction, a separation of 4.3 arc minutes. Most of us know what degrees are, okay? They're 360 degrees in a circle, 90 degrees in a right angle, 45 degrees, and yeah, anyway. 1 degree is split up into minutes, 60 minutes, and 1 minute is split into seconds, 60 seconds. And the connection between those and time have something to do with, we won't wander into, but they all go back to Babylonian civilization. So a 4.3 arc minute separation is pretty small, okay? We're talking of something there that is about 1/7 the width, apparent width of the sun or moon as viewed from by a person with naked eye. So it's pretty small, okay? So a pretty close conjunction of Venus and Jupiter on 12 August 3 BC. Then in 31 August 3 BC, so just a few weeks later, there's a conjunction of Mercury and Venus, not particularly close, but 22 minutes is still less than half a degree, okay, so pretty close. Then there are three conjunctions of Jupiter with the brightest star in the constellation Leo, Regulus. Okay, it makes three conjunctions in the course of less than a year, of course, about 8 months, 14 September 3 BC, 17 February 2 BC, 8 May 2 BC, and none of those are particularly close. It passes over the top of it and turns around and comes back, and then turns around and goes back again. That itself is rather interesting. Typically, the outer planets appear to move slowly to the left as regard the stars, and Mars takes, I'm not going to remember the numbers off my top of my head, but Jupiter takes about 12 years to make it around one orbit around the stars and come back to the same place, and Mars less time, and Saturn longer, and then they didn't know anyone's further out than that. In antiquity, there were seven planets counting the sun and the moon. So sun, moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, seven planets, and the days of the week were named for them in the Roman world. So still have some remnants of that in our own weekday names. So as it happens, a planet that is out beyond us typically moves east among the stars, except when the Earth overtakes it in its orbit. We're looking at this now from a Copernican perspective. The Earth seems to catch up with it, and so the thing stops moving to the east, turns around and moves back to the west a little bit, and then turns around and moves back to the east. And each of the outer planets makes one such loop every time the Earth goes by them. So about once a year, you make that kind of a loop. And in this particular year, that loop was such as to have Jupiter pass over Regulus three times within a few months. Then there's a very close conjunction of Jupiter and Venus again. So just the sort of thing that we had back in 12 August 3 BC, now in 17 June, so a little less than a year later. Same two planets, I'm not sure why I had them Venus-Jupiter in one and Jupiter-Venus in the other. Closer, there's some argument on how close it was. Sinnott went with 3 minutes for this one. Martin goes with 0.5 minutes, and Susan Carroll, in her article on the website, goes with 0.1 minutes. All rather close conjunctions in any case. We'll come back to that. And then about a little over 2 months later than that, on the 26th of August, there's a conjunction, actually a massing of planets. We'll look at that by and by. But Mars comes into the whole combination. And so Mars and Jupiter in conjunction and such, we'll look at that by and by. Martin suggests that these conjunctions to above, plus a configuration of the sun and moon with the constellation Virgo, something happens every year, but this year happened on the 11th September 3 BC, would have been read as follows. He's trying to give you a feel for how would this have been read by an ancient stargazer, a stargazer in the Middle East, and working largely off the characteristics which were assigned to the sun, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, etc., and the various constellations. He suggests that the conjunction in 12 August 3 BC would have been read like this. Jupiter, the king planet, having left the sun, and that means if you look at the alignments a little earlier, Jupiter has just come past the sun, it's now moving west of it. Having left the sun, the supreme father, is now conjoined with Venus, the mother. Sun, moon, and Mercury, the messenger, also located with Jupiter and Venus. And Leo, the lion, representing the tribe of Judah. And do not know how widespread the idea was that Leo, the constellation lion, represented Judah, but there's certainly some biblical support for that kind of an idea. Judah is pictured as the lion in that passage in Genesis 49, and Martin's suggestion basically is, well, these are magi. Daniel was a magus, singular magi, a few centuries earlier in Babylon area, and it would not be surprising that some knowledge of biblical things would have gotten rolling there. Besides, the whole Babylon area was a large dispersion area of the Jews, and in fact, even till 500 A.D., that's a large area of Jewish population here, the Babylonian Talmud from that later period. So that's the first conjunction, and he gets from that the this message, some important royal event is about to happen among the Jews. Just 2 weeks later, 31 August 3 B.C., Mercury, the heavenly messenger, has now moved from the sun over to Venus, and you have a conjunction now of Mercury and Venus, the mother. The sun is now in the constellation Virgo, the Virgin. Mercury and Venus are in Leo. Jupiter is just entering the same message. God's messenger sent to the mother. On 11 September 3 B.C., something happens that happens every year, but which Martin noticed, there appears to be allusion to in the book of Revelation. In Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 through 5, we have this picture of a woman who is in pregnancy, and she is clothed with the sun and the moon are under her feet. And he says, if you take that astrologically, that will mark an exact date. Take the woman to be the constellation Virgo, the Virgin, only a woman constellation in the zodiac. Then the sun clothes her body for about one month a year, because the sun moves eastward, apparently, through the zodiacal constellations, and there are 12 of them, and takes about a month through each of them, okay? And the moon whips around, all the way around, once a month. So one time, while the sun is clothing the body of Virgo, the moon will be under her feet, just under her feet, okay? And he says, in year 3 B.C., that designates the day September 11th. Martin takes this to be the date of Jesus' birth. Let me show you his overhead here. I left out an overhead I wanted to show you. But well, let me show you this other one while we're here. And that is the Leo one. Let's see what I've done with my machinery here, mastering the overhead projector. It's never a great one of mine. You realize when you look in the sky, you don't see any animals. Okay, but the ancients at least imagined animals, and the conjunction that we spoke of in August 12th is here, about 5 or 6, 7 degrees east of the bright star in Leo, and then the very close conjunction the next year is at almost exactly the same distance further on beyond that. What did I say? This one is west of Regulus, and the June 17th 2 BC east of Regulus. So you're going to have those two conjunctions. And in between, you're going to have Jupiter pass over this, and then pass back, and then pass over again in its way getting there. So we'll come back and do something of that sort in a moment, discuss that in a moment. here's the figure about Virgo, though. This is borrowed from Martin, showing you a different artist, the lion looks a little different, but there is Regulus up there. And here is the sun between August 27 and September 15th is clothing her upper and middle body, okay? And here's the moon coming down through here, and it's under her feet here on September 11th. and he has it. He's doing them every evening at 7 p.m. And the reason he's doing that is that's on Saturday at 7 p.m. When you do this with the horizon, she is diving headfirst into the horizon like this, and obviously you won't be able to see anything until the sun is set, which, being here, you're going to have to be something like this. And you'd be able to see that sort of thing. But the persons who are stargazers, professional stargazers, would know what is going on, even if they aren't able to see it at the moment, because they calculate where particular things are located. Okay, so 12 August, some important royal event is to happen among the Jews, the conjunction of Venus and Jupiter. 31 August, conjunction of Mercury and Venus, God's messenger, because Mercury is the messenger of the gods in the in Greco-Roman mythology, is sent to the mother. Okay, 11 September B.C., 11 September 3 B.C., the woman is clothed with the sun and the moon is under her feet. Martin takes this to be the date of Jesus' birth. Okay? Then the 14 September, 17 February, 8 May, conjunctions, three conjunctions of Jupiter with Regulus, brightest star in the constellation Leo the Lion, located between the lion's feet. Martin notes the prediction in Genesis 49:10. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler, or alternative translation, ruler's staff, from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs. And basically the claim here by Martin again is there is an allusion to the ruler between the lion's feet as being the star Regulus, the bright star in the constellation Leo. So the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs. If he's correct on that, it's certainly some kind of a double entendre of some sort that would be going on there. He sees then the Jupiter, the king planet, circling above Regulus, the king star, and he says that's placing a crown on the king star. That's what Mark says, placing a crown on the king star. That's his read on that. Then 17 June 2 B.C., a very rare close conjunction of Jupiter and Venus, which are variously estimated to have a separation of 3 minutes of arc senate, that's one-tenth the diameter of the sun or moon as viewed from the Earth, half a minute, so that's one-sixtieth of the diameter of sun or moon, or 0.1 minute, so what's that, 60 times 10, one-three-hundredth the diameter of the thing by Susan Carroll. Unfortunately, it's tricky to calculate something like that 2,000 years away. You're getting pretty near the edge of calculation. I have not had a chance to work into how good can we expect calculations to be. Answer, of course, is as good as you want if you've taken everything into account. But have you taken everything into account? Done that. The frequency of such a close conjunction, depending on which estimate is correct, would range from about once in 1,000 years to about once in 30,000 years, depending on the thing. See my calculations in the appendix. Martin sees this conjunction as having the same significance as the one of 12 August 3 B.C. and suggests it was the 17th June conjunction that sends the Magi on their way, arriving in Jerusalem about December 5th. 26 August 2 B.C., a close conjunction of Jupiter and Mars, god of war, in Leo, with Venus and Mercury also in Leo and the sun in Virgo. Martin suggests this sign may mean these events will lead to war. Now, interesting thing, I looked at this, run it on my computer program, which we're going to do here in a moment, presented it in our one of our courses here, because we do the Matthew 2 passage in our Synoptics course, is one of our four passages we look at. Recently I've noticed a number of things about these conjunctions that point to a modification of Martin's view. When these changes are made, the symbolism of the sequence of events suddenly snaps into focus in a remarkable way. The points, and then we'll kind of wander through it. One, Martin's 11 September event comes only 2 weeks after the 31 August conjunction in which God's messenger comes to the mother. This 31 August event sounds like Gabriel's annunciation to Mary, which would hardly be just 2 weeks before the birth. Taking 11 September's conception, however, then the really close conjunction of 17 June is just over 9 months later. This makes best sense as the birth event, which after all is what Matthew 1 and 2 is about. So, in this model, Jesus is born 17 June 2 B.C. 3. This arrangement gives a very different flavor to the three conjunctions of Jupiter with Regulus, as the baby Jesus is in Mary's womb in this period. Thus, Jupiter can be seen as God hovering over him. As an unexpected benefit, the name Regulus is a Latin diminutive of Rex, king. So the king planet is hovering over the little king. The 26 August 2 BC massing of planets, I should have this other chart up here to see that while we're talking about all those things. The 26th August 2 BC massing of planets, all the anciently known planets but Saturn clustered within a few degrees of one another in the space between Leo and Virgo, Sun, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, may indeed imply war, as Martin suggests, given the presence of warlike Mars for the first time in a sequence of conjunctions. If we assume with Martin that the Magi set out from Babylon or thereabouts at the really close conjunction of 17 June, they would have had just 70 days to get to Judea by this date. This is not unreasonable if they didn't dawdle. See the appendix. My scheme looks like this, with a date or two adjusted to fit the results of my own planetarium program. August 3 BC. Jupiter, the king planet, joins with Venus, the mother, and Leo. An important royal event, presumably birth, is about to occur in Judah. 26 August 3 BC, Mercury, the heavenly messenger, comes to Venus, the mother. The message is delivered to the mother-to-be. 11 September 3 BC, the sun clothes the body of the virgin while the moon is under her feet, the conception of the child. 14 September, 17 February, May 8, now 2 BC, Jupiter, the king planet, hovers over Regulus, the little king, who is in his mother's womb. 17 June, 2 BC, the rare close conjunction of Jupiter with Venus and Leo, almost exactly the same distance east of Regulus, as the earlier 12 August 3 BC conjunction with west of Regulus, the birth. The Magi set out for Judea and Jerusalem, its capital. 28 August 2 BC, the clustering of Sun, Moon, Jupiter, Venus, Mercury, and Mars. This means war. The Magi arrive, and Herod makes his move to kill the baby Jesus. How rare is the sequence of events we are considering here? As noted above, this will depend on the separation of Jupiter and Venus at the close conjunction of 17 June 2 BC. With Sennett's suggested separation of 3 minutes, this sort of conjunction will occur in Leo about every 1,034 years. With Martin's separation of half a minute, it will occur once every 6,260 years. With Carol's separation of 0.1 minute, once every 31,000 years. The event is seen to be even rarer when we add in a triple conjunction of Jupiter with Regulus, or alternatively, this idea that the two conjunctions are just about equally spaced on either side of Regulus. The event is seen to be even rarer when we add the triple conjunction of Jupiter with Regulus, which only occurs in this particular year because the 11-degree-wide loop made by Jupiter opposition happens to lie across the position of Regulus. This has a probability of 11 degrees divided by 360 degrees, or about 0.03. Thus, the frequency of this close Jupiter-Venus conjunction plus the triple conjunction with Regulus can be expected to happen once every 34,000 years, Sennett, every 206,000 years, Martin, or every 1,045,000 years, Carol. Rare event indeed. The symbolism of these events in their chronological order is also impressive. 12 August, 3 BC, Magi, pay attention, royal birth in Judah. 26 August, 3 BC, the heavenly messenger informs the mother. 11 September, 3 BC, the conception occurs. Triple conjunction, the king of the gods hovers over the little king. 17 June, 2 BC, the birth occurs. 28 August, 2 BC, this means war. The apologetic value of this sequence of events, which can easily be reconstructed 2,000 years later, by anyone with a home computer using planetarium program. My program costs $35 in shareware situation. You can do better than that probably now. Is enormous. The supernatural part. The purely natural models tend to run aground in dealing with the text of Matthew 2, 9, and 10, which reads as follows. 9, after they had heard the king, they went on their way. So they're coming out of Jerusalem after talking to Herod. And the star they had seen in the east, possibly star when it arose, I'm not big on that, went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. 10, when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. Greek actually, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. It's actually four occurrences of kind of quadruple statement there. The problem here is that objects at astronomical distances cannot guide someone to explicit places on the surface of the Earth by mere movement alone. Instead, this is characteristic of objects that are only a few tens of feet above the ground, as, for example, a pillar of cloud and fire in the wilderness. Martin's model, which is a purely naturalistic model, takes the verb stopped to be used in a technical astronomical sense for Jupiter ceasing its westward motion relative to the stars and beginning to move eastward once more. That is, it's doing one of these loops that I mentioned a little bit earlier, and it's just at the west end of one of those loops, which he sees as happening about 25 December 2 BC when he believes the Magi were in Jerusalem. This is nothing an observer would notice by watching Jupiter that night. Its stopping would only become apparent over the course of many nights as its relative motion among the stars would gradually come to halt and then change direction. And stopped over the place, Martin takes to mean that when the Magi came out of Jerusalem that night to go to Bethlehem, they saw Jupiter stopped in the southern sky over the village of Bethlehem, not over the particular house in which the baby Jesus was located. Since the Magi would need to know that Jupiter had reached its stopping point before moving east again by means of calculations or charts they had prepared in advance, they would hardly be surprised or overjoyed, as Matthew tells us they were. This Greek expression is quite emphatic. So I think Martin's suggestion is no good. Another suggestion for using the astronomical object to mark a location on the surface of the Earth appears in E.W. Maunder's article on the star Magi in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia under the section The Legend of the Well. Maunder reports a legend at Jerusalem that one of the Magi, looking down into the well in the inn, saw the star reflected in it, so directly overhead, and knew they had come to the right place. This is a clever suggestion, but it hardly does justice to the details of the text in Matthew. Supernatural models, by contrast, handle this problem easily. An object which is only a few tens of feet above the earth can easily guide people by moving at a speed they can keep up with and by stopping over the location to which the people are being led. In fact, the terminology used in the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament to describe the guidance provided by the pillar of fire and cloud is rather close to that used by Matthew here. Matthew uses the verb proago to indicate that the star went before or led them, the verb erkamai to indicate it's moving or coming, and histemi to indicate it's stopping or standing. In Exodus 13:21, God leads them, ago, just lacking the pro, by a pillar of cloud to show Israel the way. In Exodus 14:19, the angel of God goes before them, pro erkamai, and to protect them from the Egyptians, he moves the pillar of cloud to stand, histemi, behind them. In Exodus 33:9, whenever Moses would enter the tent of meeting, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand, histemi, at the door of the tent. And when the people saw the pillar standing, histemi, they would each rise, each stand at the door of their own tent and worship. In Numbers 14:14, Moses tells God that the Egyptians have already heard that God's cloud stands over Israel, ephistemi, epi plus histemi, and that by or in the pillar of cloud, he goes before them, poruamai, proteros. For poruamai is pretty much a synonym of erkamai. In Deuteronomy 1:33, Moses rebukes Israel for not trusting the God who went before, poruamai, proteros them, in fire by night and cloud by day to search out places to camp and to show them the way they should go. So, with a purely natural model, no ordinary reading of the text of Matthew or the phenomenon of conjunctions will guide the Magi to Jesus. In a purely natural model, this is handled easily, but the events described above in our section of natural part are just an astonishing but meaningless fluke. But how about a hybrid model? The natural model is open to retrospective calculation, while the supernatural model part fits the Matthew narrative naturally and gets the Magi to the right house in Bethlehem. Such a natural-supernatural hybrid might also make some sense of the extreme joy which the Magi experience when they see the star again. Matthew 2, 9 and 10 tells us that they again saw the star which they had seen in east, so there's a strong indication we're to identify the star they now see with that which sent them on the way. In the model we propose, if they arrive in Jerusalem on or about the 28th of August, 2 BC, then the cluster of Sun, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter in Leo Virgo will set with the Sun, since in fact the Sun is the easternmost member of the group, it will set last. So if we imagine the Magi coming out of Jerusalem as or shortly after the Sun sets, we can construct a scenario that would work very well. Suppose we speculate. We know that they would know where these planets are and that they're setting with the Sun. Suppose, as we speculate, they see a supernatural light about the size and brightness of the Jupiter-Venus conjunction of 17 June. It arises in the west from where the Sun has just set, comes toward them until it's low overhead. The star then turns southward and leads them like a pillar in the wilderness until it stops over the house where Joseph, Mary, and the child Jesus are now living. After all their travels, wouldn't that be something to make the Magi rejoice exceedingly with great joy? Literal approximation of the Greek. That's my proposal for a reconstruction of the phenomena of the Jesus star. What I want to try and do now is kind of carry this back and run this thing for you so you can see what it looked like. I'm going to now apply my hook one time to the wire. And set our thing up here. First thing we do is we move our location to Jerusalem. There's no Babylon on here. There's a Baghdad. Jerusalem. Okay, that's Jerusalem, but that's about 2,000 years too late. So we next, this is a rather nice program, we next step back two millennia, which can be done in two steps. That takes us back to 1001, and that takes us back to 1 AD. And then we step back a few years, 1 BC, 2 BC, 3 BC. And then we step forward a few months, March, April, May, June. And we're looking for, better get my chart out here. Let me put the chart up over here. We don't need my interpretation. We need that one up there. Okay. Yeah, all I need to be able to see the dates all right, I guess. Okay, we're looking at 12 August. Okay, here's June 17. I'll go forward a month. July 17, and then I'll just step us through and see what happens there. 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. There's the Sun and Jupiter right over here. We're looking at 8 a.m. Let's go a couple hours later. So we get them over here if we can see it. And we can even get rid of the help screen over here so it gives a little bit more of view. There is Leo up at the top with my pointer. Stuck in a pocket, lost forever. Okay. There's Leo. There's Jupiter. There's Venus. There's the Sun. Okay. So we're now walking towards the given date. Jupiter has come away from the Sun. I'll back you up. Here, Jupiter has a conjunction with the Sun right about the 16th of July. And now Jupiter is moving away from the Sun and toward Venus. And they're going to make their conjunction. There's the Moon zaps by. They're going to make their conjunction right there on the 12th, okay? And it looks very close on here. I would not guarantee that this particular program is going to give you a good feel on the closeness of them. But that's the first conjunction. When would that be visible? Well, with the Sun up, you can't see it. So you would basically take it around to the east and back down a few hours until the Sun is below the horizon. You would see it as Leo rises right there, and then an hour later the Sun has risen. So about an hour before the Sun rises, but that's still up pretty substantially. So that's basically what you would see. Okay, let me go back and turn that around south and move that over a few hours so we can see what we're looking at. There. That's 12 August. Okay, now watch what happens now. Jupiter and Venus are together. Here's the Sun over here. Here's Mercury here. Here's Regulus here. Now as we move on some days from there, the Mercury is going to come from the Sun over to meet Venus. And the conjunction will be right there, okay? I get 26 August. I get a little earlier than they do here, and I think I give you my date in my last discussion on that. Actually, Mercury turns around about that time, though, and comes back. So you got something going on in that general area, but I'm not going to worry about that too much. Now Jupiter is moving closer and closer to Regulus, and it will move slowly up there. Jupiter will move very fast along the line. But notice what the Sun is doing. Here's Virgo down here. This is the head of Virgo, body. This is the thing of wheat she's holding there, and her feet down this direction. Here's the Sun is now down in her body. Here comes the Moon. 9, 10, 11. And so that's what I get for 11. That's 11 in the morning, of course. And by the 12th, it's down there. So in the evening, you would get something of that sort. He did it at 7 p.m. You might go look and see what 7 p.m. looks like. Here's the Sun. This is 2 p.m. September. The Sun's about to set. There's the Sun just set. And that's 6:06. And the Moon under her feet. I get the Moon setting a little before 7 on my scale here. But whatever. Go back a few hours. Boom. Get those back up here where you see them. All right. Then we have this triplet of Jupiter-Regulus conjunctions. They're nothing much to look at. The 14th one is just about happening now. See, Jupiter and Regulus are about on top of each other right there. And so if you run this thing on, there now Jupiter has moved away from Regulus. You can see Regulus to the right and Jupiter to the left. And it will keep moving away. And if we keep tracking that, I'm going to need to back up some hours to keep it on the screen and watch what happens. Jupiter will eventually come to stop and start back the other direction. Not quite done yet. It's getting a little further away from Regulus, but there it's now about to start to come back. And it's now November, and it's February. It's going to actually pass the thing again. We're going to have to back up a few hours here in a minute to get it to do it. It's running out of scale. Let's back this up a couple hours. And run forward some more days. And now Jupiter's headed back towards Regulus. See it there. And we're in January. And we're headed into February now. And I get a conjunction. Well, there's 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Yeah, it's pretty close to his. I'd get maybe 18 times or something like that. And it's going to come on past it again. And go on a little bit. And we've got to back up a few hours to keep it on the screen. And now that turns around. That's going to start coming back again. It's now in April already, and we're aiming for a May 8th crossing again of Regulus and Jupiter. And there it does something of that sort, which, yeah, it's May 6th, so it's certainly ballpark. Okay, and now we're headed for 17 June, and let's see what happens there. May 15, we've got a month to go nearly here from Venus. Okay, look at all the stuff coming up here. Saturn won't make it. But Mercury, Mars, the Sun, Venus, etc., are all headed for a clustering. Here comes the close 17 June conjunction. Does not look as close on my machine as the other one. There it is, right there. Somewhere right in that period is a conjunction. Okay. And then 26 August is going to be the other thing. Venus and Mercury are coming this way. The Moon's going to zap by. Here comes Mars and the Sun. Mercury's going the wrong way, but we're still a ways from the end of August. Now Mercury's turning around and starting back again. Let me back up a couple hours, keep on the screen. Okay. Mercury, Mars, and Jupiter are now almost on top of each other. The Moon is coming up, and that is the 28th, which I thought was a little better clustering them 26, 3rd to 26th. Not much difference in the planets. There's my pointer. Not much difference in the planets. There's Venus down there, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Mercury. But if you go two more days, the Moon comes up into the cluster there. Even the 29th maybe is a little better. All that stuff clustered together. Now, if you notice, it's 10 in the morning. So now if we go around the west and bring that thing down to set hours, if we imagine the Magi are arriving on the 28th or 29th or something, we don't need to be exact on that particular thing, they see that this cluster of stuff is there. They know that. They can't see it because the sun is blocking everything. But they know that's setting with the sun. And so if you imagine then that as they come out, let's make it the 29th here at 6 p.m. or something of that sort, and they saw something of the right color come up from here, come up overhead to them, and then turn and carry them off down to Bethlehem. That's the sort of thing you can see up there. Okay, that's the tour. Okay, that's the paper. That's my proposal for reconstruction phenomenon of the Christmas star. I give you some sources on the next page, and then the appendix to calculate the frequency of the close conjunction and the travel time for the Magi to work out what that is. And then you actually have a set of pictures of the various conjunctions there, which are just print-offs of my computer program. So where you can have that there to see. Okay, I'll try and field some questions now. Let me get my stuff all back together here so I've got it. Yes, sir.
Can you kind of want to build all
the babies?
The
babies.
Below.
Okay, one, he had some kind of information from the Magi on when they saw the star. Don't know what they told him. On this scheme, they might have mentioned even the 12 August thing a year earlier. Herod was very careful when it concerned him. He killed three of his sons before he died for no other reason than he was afraid that they wanted to get the throne before he was ready to get rid of it. He killed his favorite wife on the basis of a claim that she had been unfaithful to him, which he never substantiated, but didn't take any chances on. But my guess is he gave himself a little margin of error. And, he heard perhaps that the star had occurred about a year ago, which would have been the first conjunction, and so he killed him 2 years old. Don't miss. Okay? That's a guess. We don't have any independent picture. We don't have any independent information about the killing of the babies. But Herod was definitely that kind of person. One other anecdote. Herod was getting near death, and he was afraid everybody was going to celebrate when he died. So he said, I'll fix that. And so he had his soldiers bring in the chief citizens from most of the villages in Palestine with orders that when he died, they'd kill them all. And so there'd be mourning at his death. When he died, I think it was Herod's sister or something of that sort, realized that they would be holding the bag if the order went to the officers to kill the people. So sent a message to the officers to let them go, and they did. And there was great rejoicing at the death of Herod.
Discussion seems to revolve on the identification of the zodiacal signs with particular, the Virgin and the Lion. How far back do those signs go, and what kind of significance would they have? I know that you've tried to address that, but specifically, do we know that they thought in terms of the same progression, the same signs that we think of today?
Yeah, we know that back into Greco-Roman period, and even late Babylonian period.
And how do we other astronomical tables? Or?
There's a fairly good astronomical table from, I think that's 1000 B.C., there are some differences in constellations on that one, but there are a bunch of them still the same as ours. We're now looking at time of Jesus. We know that the Romans and the Greeks borrowed the system from Babylon, and we've got the Roman and Greek system.
Okay. So
that's what we've got. Not all the stuff down here, Microscopium and some of the southern constellations, etc., were invented once you had Europeans going south of the equator. But all the north stuff at least goes back to late Babylonian period, something of that sort. So we're good there. I don't know of any way. We're safe on the planets. The planets have basically a flavor that Martin made them. I do not have any idea on whether the average astrologer would have thought that the lion represented Judah. My own guess is no, they wouldn't have. But a person familiar with the passage in Genesis might have gone that way. The Virgin, obviously, that's the name. Virgo is a Latin name for the constellation. Wherever it went, we moved out of that range here. Oh, it's back. Well, here it is. It's right here. So that's just a Latin name for Virgin, and Leo is not the guy's name. That's the Latin name for lion. Okay, so we're just running with the Latin names there, which go back: Libra, the scales, and Scorpio, the scorpions, and Sagittarius, the archer, and such. So those are Latin or sometimes Greek borrowed names. So that much we're safe on. Hard to press it further than that. Further questions? Yes.
For this kind of program, have you studied at least two other instances of God working in the heavens, the long day and good?
Yeah, you never pick that up in here, okay? Because this is just calculation stuck in. It has no way of detecting any strange things that happen. You're thinking probably the other one is the dial of Ahaz incident in Isaiah. Is that
right?
Yeah, yeah. No, this would not pick up either of those. So the only study I've done on those is trying to respond to the Harold Hill story that they were discovered by NASA. That, as far as I can tell, is a hoax. We have a blurb on that on our website if you want to look there. We've got our website on anything here, ibri.org. We've got some discussion on that. But this kind of program wouldn't pick that up. This kind of program would not tell you a comet, okay? It's got no comets programmed into it. Some of your more expensive ones may actually have some known comets programmed into them. Wouldn't be surprised if Halley's in. But, of course, there are a fair number of comets that occurred even in the last century that have huge long orbits on them. And so never appeared in what we might call classical civilization or anything. Would have been many thousands of years back. Question back there. About the major objection on that, one, Halley's Comet is too early, 12 B.C. And two, we do have a pretty good feel that the ancients did not regard comets as a good omen. So that wouldn't have been seen, at least as a promising sign. I don't think the Magi would have come looking for anybody with a comet. They would have stayed away or something. So I think probably we're doing better with this. Now, admittedly, the account doesn't tell us what it is. The striking thing about this is it's an enormously rare event. And that's everything. Yes, sir.
I remember years ago in a book by Harry Rimm or somebody talking about these two phenomena.
Yep. That's Harry Rimmer. My track discusses Harry Rimmer, too. He's got an earlier version of the story without Harold Hill and the NASA computers, but it's the same story. It's an astronomer at Yale. Yeah, yeah. Hoax, again, as far as I can tell. So I'll let you look at that on the website. If you've got internet connections at all, can you run in there and pick that up? I've forgotten what the title of it is, but it's... Joshua's Long Day, huh?
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. That's what I say. I wrote a tract on the subject. The Harold Hill story looks like an updated version of the Harry Rimmer story. Both of them have a skeptic or skeptics convinced when they find these things. It's done with computers and NASA in the Harold Hill story. In the Harry Rimmer story, it's a Yale astronomer and such who does it. Harry Rimmer's story mentions somebody. He mentions by name a professor at Yale. And that professor at Yale is a British Israelist, professor of military science or something at Yale until the 1890s when he quit his job because the Lord was coming back in a couple years. And he was a British Israelist. And he had written a book called Joshua's Long Day in the Dial of Ahaz or something like that. I'm doing this off the top of my head. It's written out in the tract. When you go back and look at the story in that, there's no story. Back in the work by the guy, who's the guy's name? Not coming up with the name. Anyway, he basically is using a fellow's almanac who claims to have discovered the day of creation and to have counted it for every day since then. And that guy is Jabez Bunting Dimbleby, the head of the British Chronological Association. Which for several years issued a almanac called All Past Time, that claimed to have accounted for all time since the creation. And what this other guy noticed, not have still haven't got his name, is that in Dimbleby's calculations, the first day was a Monday, but everybody knows the first day was a Sunday in order to have the seventh day to the Sabbath. So there's a day missing. And then since 10 degrees of it are missing at the dial of Ahaz, you put 15 minutes there, and then you put the rest of it at Joshua's Long Day, etc. So as far as I can tell, it involved no independent evidence. But it has gotten blown up into two snazzy stories since then. That's all on our website, so if you want to download that, that's also available on the track, but I don't get them down here. So that is an interesting area. This kind of thing would not find that, though. This would just crank back and really, you need some independent information from antiquity to even check a couple of these sorts of things, like exactly where something is. But I felt pretty good because mine finds these conjunctions that Roger Sinnott found with the big monster computers, which were slower and probably had less memory than mine does. But the monster computers that were used to do the tables of the planetary, lunar, and solar conjunctions, and Martin uses some kind of computer setup, and Susan Carroll uses. The Sky, which is a snazzy planetarium program, but she probably paid $275 for it. And she also had somebody do a program to try and measure that distance that got the tenth of a minute separation. I've not tried that, so I'm not about to try that calculation. Let's try back here first. Yeah.
Are we familiar with the Magi connected with
Yeah, I think you've got to say that whatever they saw, it told them that there's going to be some kind of a royal birth in Judah, because they come up and they say, "Where's the star? Where is the king who has been born? Where is the one who's been born king of the Jews?" Okay. Now, of course, if they know it's in Judah, then Jerusalem's the place to go. That they would certainly have known, as any educated person would have known in the Mesopotamian Valley would have known that Jerusalem was the capital of Judea. They wouldn't know to go to Bethlehem, okay? So they come into Judea. They're not following the star. You read the passage, it says nothing about following the star until they leave Jerusalem to go to Bethlehem that evening. It didn't say, we followed the star from the east. It said, we saw a star in the east, and we've come to worship him. So this particular scheme gets you that information if they know to identify Leo with Judah. And if they know the Old Testament, that would not be unreasonable. That is a messianic passage. Okay, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until the one comes to whom it belongs. And to him, the obedience of the tribes is, or something like that, is an approximation of that.
Just an observation. In order to try to build that connection, we had historically the Babylonian captivity, where you had basically the leaders of Egypt carried back to Babylon. So we can place the right people and the right background and information and stories that they would have carried with them, with the wise men, if you will, of Babylon at a point in history prior to this. So there's a very real possibility of an exchange of information and some of these connections between the prophetic work of we see in the Old Testament and some of the Babylonian wisdom, the Magi's wisdom, you know, may indeed have some real connection there. I don't think we're necessarily grabbing it strong.
No, that I think not. You got to figure that Daniel must have made some impression on the wise men of Babylon, given the things that happened there. So where we are beyond that, hard to say. A Magi, rather a vague term. It's got bad terms like magician, and it's got good terms like wise men. It's got pretty wide range, good range of meaning, etc. These guys are somebody we would call astronomers or astrologers. Not a clear distinction between that and antiquity. They certainly had warrant to believe that there's a god. The Zoroastrian, we don't know that for sure. If they're Zoroastrian, they would be working with a god who might very well do something in the sky. Yeah, further questions? Let's try here, and then we'll come over here. Yep.
Herman. According to the Bible, they just the way that over in Palestine, it might not be the 25th of December. Is there any other day that this way phenomenon is
I don't know of any historical statement about this phenomenon. So at the moment, we're stuck with computer reconstructions of the thing. So this is not something that the average person would notice particularly. If they're out at the right time, they might. If it's as close as Carol has it, maybe even as close as Martin has it, then two of your brightest objects in the sky other than the sun and moon come close enough together that they look like one object. When you're getting down to a 0.1 or 0.5 minute thing, you're getting something that close. So if you're out and you see it, what you'd say, that's interesting. I don't think the average person would have much feel on how rare it is. A person who was a stargazer, particularly a professional of some sort, had some access to Babylon's records, etc., would have a better idea that it's very rare. That much they know. Yeah, let's see. We have a question here.
Do you think it's natural or supernatural?
Both. The front part was the natural part, that's the conjunction, etc., and the supernatural part would be, I guess, okay, this object that rises out of the sunset comes to them, turns around, and goes down, but it's coming from where the objects were, okay, and they'd know that, okay, and it's leading them, and it makes good sense then of they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. There's a very strong statement there that something striking happened at that point. And that would fit best, I think, something like that.
In the account, too, you have the dream sequence, too, where they're warned in dream not to return to Herod. So you see divine supernatural
intervention.
Intervention basically going on, you know, in the Magi's experience around this, too. So that idea of seeing them being led, too, as being part of that and then being directed away from
them. Yeah, good.
Is something I think is reasonably consistent.
Yeah, good. Good, good. Let's see, we head here next, I think.
The thing that the human had a sign at the time, were they close to the star, so that's this kind of star? What would it?
If they could find anything astrologically significant, they'd make a big deal on it. I don't think there's a question about that.
If they could read the star and say it's somewhere between the
four. I don't.
How did they hear it?
Yeah. Don't know the answer to that. Certainly, they were watching the sky. They were attempting to interpret the events, okay, and such. So a number of the discussions of this particular one have claimed that these things could have been read by the Romans as auspicious signs for Augustus's reign, which he was about to reach a 50-year jubilee, would have been about a 30-year jubilee or something of that sort. But my take on that is, no, in fact, a cluster gives you some pretty strong a symbolic phenomena that that points in the direction that that the biblical account would fit. So that's how I do that work. Yeah, your question.
You mentioned that comet. Is there any evidence of a supernova or other?
There's some evidence of supernova. I've forgotten the year, 5 or 6 BC or something like that, a Chinese observation of supernova. So, Susan Carroll discusses two or three of these things in the first part of her book, in the first part of her article, which is on the web. So you can download that easily enough, and I give you the address here in my sources. Thing here, Carroll, Susan S. Star of Bethlehem, an astronomical historical perspective, etc. She doesn't go the direction I do on the symbolism of it, though she does think it's that this is the thing, and she winds up with this close conjunction, at least, as being the being that. Yeah, further. Yes, here.
They're traveling westward. You're saying that they're keeping charts because their angle.
Oh no.
As they move westward, they're seeing things a little different.
Yeah. No, I didn't get into that. They would know by their own stuff that they've got, their own records they've got, where the planets are. Certainly the Babylonians had a good handle on planetary movements and such. We've got a lot of information on that. So they don't really need to look at anything. They, having seen the thing in the first place, they see it, suggest they see the symbolism of it. They know to go to Jerusalem not by following any star, but by this as being in the constellation of Judah. And it's a royal birth thing, okay? So the only following I see is the trip from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, just that 8 miles. And that's all after the discussion with Herod, et cetera. They already know that the Old Testament prophecy predicts, in Micah, predicts a Bethlehem birth, and they're coming out presumably to head that way, and they see the thing again, and they're overjoyed, et cetera. And it leads them to the place. However hard you push place is hard to say, but I'd take it probably house.
How does this relate to the, the nativity scene show Jesus as a baby when the Magi arrive? And in fact, he's not called a baby, and he's said to be living in a house, not a stable. How do we, with the timing, I think it's not the word infant that's used, right?
Yeah, no, it's used, it's shoot, Pideon, something like that is being used instead of Rephos. On this scheme, we put him about 2 months old, a little over 2 months old. House, hard to know what to make of that, because there's a big argument in the first place of whether he's born in the stable of an inn or whether he's born in the stable of a home, and now perhaps he's moved over to the main part of the home or something of that sort. So there's some argument there on what to do with that. This will work all right for the two-year thing as long as you have Herod make himself a big margin error, though you're obviously now working off the first conjunction rather than the second conjunction. I should point out that this requires a later date for Jesus' birth than has been characteristic of the last 50 years or so, where there's been a 4 BC or 5 or 6 BC date. That's been largely because the date of Herod's death has been taken at 4 BC because of an eclipse of the moon in 4 BC and a remark in Josephus that Herod's birth occurred in connection with the eclipse. I've forgotten whether it's right before it, right after it, whatever Josephus says. Martin, I think, makes a rather impressive case here that there's also an eclipse in 1 BC, and that the events that Josephus mentions between the eclipse and Passover are too many to get in the 4 BC event, but they're enough to get in the 1 BC. You get an extra month or two between the eclipse and Passover in the other case. I'm not a chronologer, so I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but it seemed to me made a convincing case there, which is necessary at least to see that. So, yes, question here.
Do you think it's a conjunction of planets or supernovas?
Conjunction of planets is what we got in this particular model, okay? It's, in fact, a double conjunction of Jupiter and Venus in Leo, about a year apart, with one being the first announcement and the second one being the birth. And in between, it's got another planetary conjunction, Mercury-Venus, which looks like the Annunciation, and then got this woman clothed in the sun with the moon under her feet, that I suggested was the conception, and then the conjunction of Jupiter with the star Regulus three times in the course of the 9 months between the conception and the birth, and then the birth taking place, and then even this one, which would work rather well for Herod's activity, Mars showing up. And in a time period, I work out in the back here, that if the Magi travel between 10 and 15 miles a day, which shouldn't be hard with horses or camels or something, that they could easily get there. So we've been looking at the discussion back there on that. So obviously we don't know how far they were coming. I'm working with Babylon area, which got 760 miles, I think, going up the Euphrates and across to Palmyra and down to Damascus and then in, which is the way you go around the desert there. Okay, further question. One last question.
The Magi
gospel and stars. An attractive idea, but I think it's got some troubles. That was proposed by Francis Rolleston back in 18-something or another at Keswick, in British Keswick, but then picked up and popularized by Bullinger and Seitz in two books, which both have somewhat similar titles. One's The Gospel and the Stars, and the other one is... Who knows?
The question is, what made them think this is the star?
Yeah, well, that was my suggestion here on the first conjunction. Some royal event, probably a birth in Judah.
Why would they think that?
They might again have been aware of the Old Testament, in which Balaam's prophecy says a star will arise out of Jacob, and it will smite the corners of Sheth, I think is how that goes, which again has been seen as a messianic prophecy. You know, don't know. Don't know otherwise. I mean, can I tell you? So we don't know whether they had any visions or anything before they have the dream here at the end of this account. They don't say so. They don't say, we saw a vision in the east. They say, we saw a star. And how do you know it's his star? Well, this is a suggestion that at least makes some sense. One close and one very close conjunction. Both in Leo, both of Jupiter, King Star, with Venus the mother, etc. So it seems to me at least a reasonable.